It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Co-host Veronica Rickard will be back with me on Tuesday. Coming up, a project at UW Green Bay wants your memories, stories, and photos from Packer games, Packer history throughout the decades. We'll find out how we can all join in and participate. But first, President Obama announced he'd like to make community college accessible to everybody. Under his plan, that would mean making the first 2 years of community college free through a federal matching grant for qualified students. Paul Fain is with us to describe the president's plan. He's a news editor for Inside Higher Ed. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
So what's the goal of this proposal? Why community colleges in particular?
Well, I think the president has said that the main goal is to get as many students as possible into the higher education pipeline. And, you know, community college students can transfer on to get a bachelor's degree. They also stand a better chance of getting a job and, as he says, entering the middle class.
I know some of the funding details are still up in the air, but what do we know so far about how this would affect who pays what for a community college?
Well, the taxpayer estimate that we heard today from the White House is that this would be about $6 billion a year. Once again, that is an estimate. $60 billion over 10, they're saying. That would be to make up the difference between existing federal aid and what states would be contributing. And that means states that would participate in this towards the total cost of tuition and fees for community college. And the White House is saying for, you know, students in these participating states, it would be about $3,800 in savings per year for each student.
And so states would decide whether or not to sign on. If they did, the feds would cover a big chunk of this, but the states would have to make up the gap, right?
Correct. The federal contribution would be 75% or three quarters, and that would include existing federal aid programs like the Pell Grant, this new money, if it does come. And, you know, the interplay between the Pell Grants and whatever this money might be is still kind of a mystery, and the details for that have not been released yet.
And are we talking about, you know, a student just out of high school here, or maybe somebody later in their career who wants to retrain for a different line of work?
Good question. As I understand it, to some extent, this is based on a new and a very promising program out of Tennessee that is based on students who are just out of high school. The Tennessee Promises, it's called, scholarship. Pretty similar. It is for students who just graduated. 90% of the state's high school graduates from last year signed up. I think that is the primary focus, is getting folks to go directly from high school.
And tell me more about the Tennessee Promise. How long have they been doing that? It sounds like it's gotten a big response so far.
It was just passed last year by a Republican governor, interestingly, who appeared, Governor Haslam, with the president today in Tennessee, as well as two Republican senators from Tennessee. So, you know, the president's really trying to make this a bipartisan idea, showing that it kind of bubbled up from Republicans. But yeah, this is a scholarship that does a very similar thing. It fills the gap between what the feds pay and the total cost of tuition. So it would be two free years of tuition. And the state of Tennessee actually set aside a $300 million endowment from lottery funds to pay for it. So even when Haslam is gone, that money presumably would still be there. It wouldn't be subject to the whims of annual budgeting.
What's been the reaction so far in the higher education world to this suggestion from the president?
There's a lot of excitement. I had a community college system president, the president of the Indiana Community College System, Tom Snyder. He called it the GI Bill for the 21st century. Obviously one of the most noteworthy proposals in higher education in years. There's certainly some concern. Usually when government does come up with new spending ideas, it means the money comes from elsewhere. I think there are some four-year colleges that might be concerned about this driving students away from them or funding. But I think the message that, you know, college is for everyone, and that this generation of students, you know, all doors, the doors are open to them, has largely been met with positive.
Now, presumably the hope is that there's going to be some kind of economic payoff here. What's the thinking behind getting more students past a high school degree into some community college as far as the future of the economy goes?
Well, there are 31 million Americans out there with some college and no degree. And that's a problem that few would deny. And I think the idea here is to get students to get something, to earn a certificate, earn an associate degree and to enter the workforce, and then maybe later go on to get a bachelor's degree. There's been some really promising research that shows that certificates and associate degrees really do land good jobs. And I think that's where this idea does have some bipartisan support, in part because businesses and Republicans, I think, see that this can be good for the workforce, the economy, and for hiring by companies.
Are there particular kinds of education and careers that we're focusing toward? Maybe healthcare, where there are a lot of jobs, a high tech, where there's sometimes talk of a lack of trained high tech workers?
Those are two of the big ones, for sure. Healthcare is big, IT, some of the, what we call it, STEM fields as well, engineering and science. But it can be other things, too. It can be certificates as well. The president is looking at making this a transfer pathway, meaning from an associate degree to a bachelor's degree. Also, some of the technology certificates. You know, welding is a job that has a tremendous demand, very high pay, sometimes over $100,000 a year, and you can get those certificates at a community college.
How well do you think this is going to go over in the country, maybe on the political side as opposed to the higher education side?
Well, it certainly faces an uphill battle, but all new funding in the federal government does. It's going to be tough, for sure. There's already been some negative reaction from Republicans. It's a little harder to oppose the idea than some other ones. I think most people want to see more access to community colleges and higher education. And I do think the president was canny in doing this with Republicans in a state that is dominated by Republican leadership. So there's certainly some bipartisan interest, but new spending is always a tough sell.
You mentioned, again, Tennessee. They've got this program there, support for it from the Republican governor there. Have other states or even local areas experimented with anything like this in recent years?
Good question. Two states, Oregon and Mississippi, floated bills last year to do a similar thing. They didn't go anywhere, in part because of the money. Chicago, the City Colleges of Chicago, which is a big community college system, has just recently started a similar scholarship that is going to happen. It's much narrower, however. It has a little bit stricter eligibility requirements for students. They have to have a 3.0, and by some estimates, only about 3,000 of the 20,000 students who graduate from Chicago high schools would qualify for it. But it is, it's a similar idea, and the president actually celebrated that in the last couple of days as well.
We had an email from a listener. Paul says, I went to a well-regarded public high school, but a lot of it was kind of slow and inefficient academically before or maybe alongside extending public education yet further. They should fix what we already have so that students aren't wasting so much time in their earlier years. So maybe focus on what we're trying to accomplish in community college by doing more of it in the high school years, Paul is saying. What do you think, Paul Fain?
Well, the person has identified, Paul, I should say, a really key problem. A lot of students come into community college not prepared for college-level work, and the community colleges themselves have to remediate that. I would say that there's a lot of work going on at community colleges to work more directly with high schools. You'd think that had been happening before, but it wasn't as much as it should to align the curriculums, even sometimes to send community college faculty members into high schools to really make sure that students have the right math and English skills when they get to college. And, I think one big question for the president's plan is it's 2 free years of community college. Very few students actually complete their associate's degree in 2 years. Oftentimes it's because they're working, but sometimes it's because they do have those remedial needs and can't actually get through the material in time.
We'll leave it there for now. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. Enjoyed it.
That's Paul Fain. He's news editor for Inside Higher Ed. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Food Friday, we'll learn how to make delicious and healthy food in our slow cookers from the experts at America's Test Kitchen. Now, some Packers pregame and some football history. In just a moment, we'll check out an effort to collect fans' stories, photos, and memories in a UW Green Bay project. First, the Packers are hosting the Dallas Cowboys in this weekend's NFC divisional playoffs at Lambeau Field. First time the two teams have met for the playoffs in Green Bay since the famous 1967 Ice Bowl. Patty Murray reports.
It's cold in Green Bay, but not as cold as it was December 31st of 1967 when the temperature was 15 below zero.
I feel fine except for my face.
Yeah. Packer CEO Mark Murphy was kicking off a Paint the Town Green and Gold campaign by spray painting a slogan on a downtown street. He says players are ready and doesn't think the cold will be a factor. Instead of 15 below, temperatures this weekend could hit 15 above.
Yeah, the technology, everything's so much better now, and the heaters on the sidelines, and we've got, you know, our field is heated, so we should never have a frozen tundra. Now, I think, I've always been very impressed with the way our players and players generally have been able to perform in all kinds of weather, and you think back in 67, they didn't have so many of the advantages that we have now in terms of keeping people warm and be able to play in the conditions. So it's pretty remarkable that the players were able to play the way they did back in that time.
The game is remembered for the heart-stopping action on the field just as much as for the weather. Quarterback Bart Starr went in for a last-minute game-winning touchdown. It's a game that'll live in the annals of sports history, according to Green Bay Press Gazette sports writer Wes Hodkowitz.
I believe it was Ken Bowman and Jerry Kramer, the offensive lineman, opening up the hole and Starr going right through it. And the Dallas defensive line, I think it was the Doomsday defense, they were known for being able to stop teams in short yardage situations. For it to not only be that scene in that, environment, but to come down to a significant play like that, a last-second play, that just doesn't happen a lot. That's magic.
A lot of things have changed since 1967, but not the love John Hess and Mel McCartney have for their team. The Madison area Friends will be in the stands Sunday in the same seats they were back then. John Hess knows because he embroidered his seat number in his vintage Cromer hat.
Our seat is in section 116, row 7, seat 23, as I read my hat.
The two may need a reminder of where their seats are, but McCartney will never forget the cold that day. So he thinks this weekend's temperatures won't be a big deal.
That's a big difference in terms of how you can function. And one of the key things is the ball freezes at 15 below. I mean, the ball will be cold here and hard, but that ball gets like a rock when it's 15 below.
The Ice Bowl is like the Woodstock of football. McCartney says if everyone who says they were there actually was there, Lambeau Field would have had to have been a lot bigger.
Instead of 53,000, it had been 530,000. I mean, people wanted to be there and were there in spirit, but they forgot they really weren't there.
Whichever team wins at Lambeau on Sunday will play either the Seattle Seahawks or the Carolina Panthers in the NFC Championships. From there, the winner will meet the AFC champions in the Super Bowl. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A lot of memories from the Ice Bowl, and our next guests want to collect those and other stories from Packer fans. Chuck Ryback and Kate Farley join us now. Chuck's an associate professor of English at UW Green Bay. Both of them are organizers of the Packers Project. Chuck, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks a lot.
And Kate, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Chuck, start us off with the basics. What is the Packers Project?
It's basically a fan-sourced history project, where we're just looking to reach out to Packers fans, really, I mean, locally, globally, even, just to collect as much, interesting, unique stuff as possible, whether it's memories, artifacts, photos, just all of the stuff that's out there that's uncollected and undocumented. We're hoping to gather it and put it in one place where people can come and look at it.
And Kate, what kinds of things have you collected so far from Packers fans?
Well, recently we have just added an archives collection because we were able to secure a whole bunch of really cool stuff from the UWGB archives. So right now we have a picture of Curly Lambeau in fourth grade. So that's pretty exciting that we can see that on the site and people can look back at the memory of Curly Lambeau. But we also have a couple of new things that were just contributed since we had our press release, I guess you would call it, in the Press Gazette. And we had somebody contribute a story about how the Packers painted his house after he had had a back injury. So things like that are coming in right now, but a lot of really exciting stuff.
And Chuck, what's the why behind the project? Why do we want a fan-sourced collection of Packers history?
There are a couple things. There is a recent example that I sort of based this on. There's a project out of Northeastern University called the R Marathon Project, which was a crowdsourced collection that was based on the Boston Marathon bombing. And it was really interesting to see, I mean, the subject's obviously a lot different, how they just collected anecdotes, but then they populated them into maps, and there were individual narratives attached to certain times of day and so forth. And when I saw something like that, and that's a very specific period of time, I thought, you know, we could do this for the Packers, that except it would be so much bigger. It would extend over really generations. And also just the love of history. I work in the humanities, and Kate was a humanities student. And, you know, there's a lot of untapped history out there that, you know, we're really interested in narrative and the stories that people have to tell. And it just seemed like this was a perfect opportunity with the technology being what it is today, that we can actually collect that and share it and really revel in it. And so it just seemed like a great opportunity. And plus, we're in Green Bay. I mean, we are the university, and it just felt like we should have something connected to the Packers since we're so uniquely positioned to do it.
Kate, you joined this as Chuck just mentioned, as a student. What got you interested in the Packers project?
Well, I was a student, and now I'm working in academic tech services. So some of the skills that I've learned from these kinds of projects, like digital scholarship, is what made me really interested in the first place, along with being a cheesehead. so I guess being able to put my skills forth to help with something that as important as this. And like Dr. Ryback said, it's a repository of memories. Like, we're making something for people to remember, and we're documenting it so that it doesn't get lost.
And Chuck, I know one of the goals, of course, is to get people to participate. So if there are listeners out there saying, hey, I've got a great story, I've got a great photo, what a great fan superstition, how do they get it to you?
Yes, we are waiting for them. All you have to do is go to the website for it, which is packersproject.org, and Packers Project is all one word. And when once you're there, you'll see a giant contribute button. It's hard to miss. And really, you just click on that, and it will take you through a series of options to help you submit what it is, whether it's photo, you could do audio. There's even space for shorter video. We're also really interested in just the quirky memorabilia that people have. So if you have photos of that, but then you would just go there, fill out the form, upload the material, just like you would anywhere else on the web, really. And then it would go into moderation for a little bit, because on our end of it, there really is a student, you know, an educational experience where the students are curating and organizing and so forth. So it would be in moderation for a little bit, but it would be up soon enough.
And, Kate, I saw a picture of former Packer receiver and return man Bill Schrader and a bunch of the project team. Are you meeting a lot of players as you go about this?
Well, that was actually an opportunity provided by the university as well. We had a UWGB Packers Day at Lambeau. So we had Bill Schrader there, and we decided it would be a really good opportunity to meet with him and tell him about our project. So that's really the only thing so far, but I'm hopeful we'll be able to get some more Packer players on there.
Right. They'll obviously all want to meet us now that they know.
Right.
And get your autographs, too, yeah.
Exactly.
So in the stories you're getting, are you seeing more, you know, Packer triumph-related ones like the Ice Bowl or, you know, the tough moments? I don't want to make anybody cry out there, but like 4th and 26, I won't say any more about that. But are you hearing the happy moments or the sad moments more, Chuck?
You know, they're more just like the personal moments that are not really connected to specific games so much. We did have somebody who came into the GB day that said that he was at the Ice Bowl, and we didn't have a verification thing there or anything, but not so much yet anything about specific games that way, but really just more like the first time being there, more personally focused stuff, I would say.
And Kate, any interesting superstitions? I know that's one of the things you're hoping to get from people.
I think one person was saying how they had a ritual for what they were going to be wearing, and we collected that story from the UWGB day too. And it makes me laugh, but people have these things that they do. Like, another person can only have their remote facing a certain way when it's right on the ball.
And there's somebody with a ring.
A lot of people have things like that.
Chuck, somebody with a ring, you said?
Yeah, there's a Super Bowl, like a miniature Super Bowl ring that, not a Super Bowl ring from winning the Super Bowl, but just shaped like the trophy that the person must wear on game day. So,
do you, Chuck, have a favorite memory that you've put on here?
I'm sort of new to the area, but if I were to add it, it would be that I went to my very first regular season game this year, and I went to the Monday night game against the Falcons, and it was fantastic. And that is my favorite memory so far, just being there and being a part of it. I'm also from Buffalo, New York, originally, and the Bills did come here for a family day scrimmage a few years back, and so I got to see the Bills and the Packers in the same place, and that was pretty great.
Neither team a stranger to cold weather. Well, Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, no, thank you. I really appreciate it.
And Kate, thanks to you as well.
Thank you for having us.
We've heard from Chuck Ryback and Kate Farley. They are with the Packers Project at UW-Green Bay. If you have a memory or a photo or a story to share, we have linked that project on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard is off today. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is off today. One of your New Year's resolutions might be to cook more often, maybe cook more healthy, but you don't know where to start. Well, how about crockpots or slow cookers? Easy way, it turns out, to make healthy meals. For a lot of recipes, you just put the ingredients in the crockpot, set the temperature, wait 6 or 8 hours, and you've got a delicious meal on your hands. Well, here to introduce us to healthy crockpot cooking and share some great tips to boost things up a little bit, we've got Jack Bishop with us. He's editorial director for America's Test Kitchen. Jack, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Happy New Year.
So you've got a new book about, Happy New Year to you, by the way. You've got a new book out about healthy crockpot cooking. Why did you tackle this?
Well, I think people think about beef stew, chili, pulled pork, all these things that we love, but many of them that are not all that good for us as being things you make in a slow cooker. And what we really wanted to do was to change people's minds and say, it's not just those fatty, delicious cuts of meat that you can throw in your slow cooker. You can basically cook almost anything in your slow cooker as long as you come up with a recipe that makes sure to treat that food correctly. Even something as delicate as fish actually does tremendously well in a slow cooker. And so we really looked at vegetables, grains, lean poultry, lean cuts of meat, fish, and what are the best ways to cook that in a slow cooker so that, as you said, it's such a great joy to be able to just make an entire meal, walk away and come back hours later, lift off the lid, and you've got dinner. But can that be a healthy dinner? And the answer is definitely yes.
Well, before we get into some of the particulars about how to make these healthy meals, let's look at the equipment. What kind of slow cooker should we be looking for to meet our needs?
Well, the first thing to do is to think about size. Are you somebody who is cooking for one or two people, in which case you probably want what we call a small slow cooker, which is around 4 quarts. If you're somebody who's cooking for a family, then you really want to be looking for something that's 6 quarts. Most recipes can be made in either a 4 or a 6 quart, but you may as well get the right size for you. The second thing is we tested all kinds of leading models and came up with our top-rated models in the test kitchen in both sizes. We love the KitchenAid 6-quart slow cooker, and if you want a small 4-quart one, we love the Cuisinart. And a couple things that they do that we like is that when the food is done and you're not home, it will switch over to keep warm, which is a really important function. Some slow cookers will just keep on going, and so if you're stuck in traffic and you get home late, that food may have cooked longer than you want if you don't have a keep warm mode. And so that's one of the things we really, really look for in a slow cooker. We love glass lids, so you can really see what's going on in there. And simple controls. We find that the more complicated the controls, usually it makes it more complicated to figure out how to use the slow cooker. And frankly, the only thing you really need is a timer and a high and a low setting, and we generally use the low setting because it's a little bit more gentle.
Now, one of the points you make in the book is that you can use leaner cuts of meat and not dry them out in the slow cooker. What's the key to take? It's added chicken breast is something I do a lot, and which is low in fat but pretty easy to be bland and dry if you do it wrong. How do you make it nice and yummy in your slow cooker?
Well, there are two things. One is this, you know, the slow cooker, because you've added moisture, it's a naturally smart way to cook lean foods because it's so gentle. You know, if you try to put a lean cut of meat like a chicken cutlet on a super hot grill, for instance, it usually dries out and gets pretty leathery. And so you've got the advantage that it's a moist, steamy environment. But what you really need to do is pump up the flavors. Whether you're, you know, making a slow cooker with a fat cut or a lean cut, the slow cooker tends to wash away flavors. And so you need to add a lot more garlic, a lot more onions, a lot more spices, tomato paste, soy sauce, you know, all these things that add flavor. You're going to need to use more than you think you're going to need in order to pump up the flavor of the chicken, the fish, whatever it is you're cooking.
Yeah, I do chicken paprikash sometimes in my slow cooker, and man, do I have to use a lot of paprika to get through that.
You do, and I have a little trick for you. We found that all of those aromatics, the onions, the garlic, the spices, to toss them with a little bit of oil in a small bowl and then microwave them for a couple of minutes to basically bloom the flavors in those spices or in the garlic. And, you know, you don't want to get out a skillet and start cooking things in a skillet in order to make a slow cooker recipe, but it's easy enough to throw all those ingredients into a bowl, throw it in the microwave for a couple of minutes until it's fragrant, and then scrape all of those aromatics into the slow cooker. And what it really does is release all of the flavors from the paprika, from the cumin, the chili powder, the garlic, anything like that. It's better to put it in the slow cooker with a little bit of oil. There's a lot of fat-soluble compounds in those spices, and so the vegetable oil sort of helps release and carry those flavors throughout the dish.
So the sound you heard there was my mind being blown by this. Just really a minute or whatever in the microwave with the onions and the spices and the sauce really brings out that much more flavor?
Yeah, it really does make a difference. If you've got onions, you're going to want to be cooking them probably 3 to 5 minutes.
Okay.
Just some spices, you know, a minute's going to be fine. If there's some tomato paste, which we often use, you know, tomatoes are packed with umami, the thing that makes things savory tasting, and so we often add a little bit of tomato paste to a lot of recipes, even ones that don't really have tomato. So you can throw that in with the spices, and it just brings out their flavor and makes a huge difference. And you're also going to need a little bit more spices. You know, if you make the same dish conventionally on the stovetop, we find you often add 50% or even 100% more of those key ingredients because, you know, things tend to wash out after hours and hours of cooking in a slow cooker.
Well, let's before we move on from chicken, the recipe that you shared with us from the book, we've got it on the Central Time Facebook page, sweet and tangy pulled chicken. Can you tell us about this dish?
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite things to make in a slow cooker is to take a pork shoulder and make pulled pork. Now, it tastes great, but it's not exactly on the healthy regimen of something you can be eating every week. But we wondered, could we make the same dish, basically, using chicken and do, you know, a pulled chicken with all of those great barbecue flavors and then put it on buns and top it with a really, really, you know, tangy, crisp, crunchy slaw. And we found, actually, you know, most of the secret of that dish is in the onions, the tomato paste, the chili powder, the paprika, the cayenne, the molasses, the ketchup, and that whether it's chicken or pork, it's not as different as you would think it would be.
Huh.
And that we use bone-in split chicken breasts. So, you know, using the bone-in breasts adds some additional flavor, and then, of course, you take the meat off the bone and shred it. And it's just incredibly lean. It's only 90 calories per serving. Now, this is before you add a bun. Now, of course, you're going to add a bun, and so it's going to add some calories. But, I mean, the chicken and the, you know, the sauce, it's not quite zero calories, but 90 calories for something that you can make for dinner is about as low as it gets. You know, add a nice healthy bun and then some slaw, and it's just fabulous.
And you're, in effect, making your own barbecue sauce. Better to do that than just get a store-bought sauce and dump it in the crock pot?
Yeah, I mean, most of the store-bought sauces, the flavors are kind of out of whack and they're awfully sweet. There's some exceptions. We like Bullseye among the commercial sauces is our favorite. But it takes literally 5 minutes. This is a recipe where we'll use that microwave trick. So we'll microwave a chopped onion, tomato paste, chili powder, a little bit of vegetable oil, paprika and cayenne for 5 minutes. Throw that in the slow cooker along with some ketchup and molasses. And, you know, you add the chicken, and 2-3 hours later, the chicken is cooked. And that's one of the things you need to think about with lean proteins like chicken and fish. These are often not 8 or 9 hour recipes. I mean, you know, think about if you were cooking chicken on the stovetop or in the oven versus, you know, a fatty cut like pork. You need to cook it less. It will dry out if you cook it for 8 hours. But these are great weekend recipes while you're puttering around and doing other things in the house or running out and doing errands to make sweet and tangy pulled chicken. It's just a fabulous way to, you know, watch a ball game, maybe Sunday afternoon, have a healthy but delicious treat.
It's a sweet and tangy pulled chicken. We've got that recipe, a crockpot recipe, on the Central Time Facebook page. Let's take a radical departure from that now, Jack. Greens in the crockpot.
Yeah, you know, I think we all want to be eating more hearty greens, kale, turnip greens, mustard greens. And, you know, a lot of the classic recipes are slow cooked. Think about, you know, Southern style braised greens. Well, there's no reason why you can't braise those greens in a slow cooker and go do something else while they're cooking rather than standing by the stovetop and watching them. And so we think green beans are great. All of those hearty grains are really, hearty greens rather, are really wonderful in the slow cooker. You add all of the flavors in that you want. You could add Asian flavors, classic Southern flavors if you want. You can do the same thing and build a soup with them. One of my favorites is to just do garlicky braised greens and to do it with kale, a little bit of chicken broth, so you need some liquid. You could use vegetable broth if you want to make it vegetarian, some hot red pepper flakes, a lot of garlic, some salt and pepper, and then just finish it with, and this is another trick with a lot of slow cookers, is to think about finishing them with some additional flavor. And so just a teeny pat of butter for richness, just a tablespoon for 4 servings, and a little bit of red wine vinegar. You could use cider vinegar if you want, even a squirt of lemon juice just to give it a little perk up. And so a lot of citrus, vinegars, herbs, we'll throw those in at the very end so that we preserve those flavors and sort of perk up the flavors in a slow-cooked greens. And these greens are, this is an all-day recipe. You know, you can put the 2 pounds of kale in the slow cooker for 8 hours and, you know, come home and got a pot of greens to go with cornbread or whatever you want to serve it with.
Jack Bishop is making us hungry right now. He's with America's Test Kitchen. They've got a new book out, The Healthy Slow Cooker Revolution. We were talking about healthy crockpot recipes on this edition of Food Friday, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your go-to crockpot recipe? Do you have a healthy one you can tell us about? Any questions about cooking with the crockpot or tips to share? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post and find a recipe on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about healthy crockpot recipes. We have Jack Bishop with us from America's Test Kitchen. One of their new books, The Healthy Slow Cooker Revolution. You can join in, 800-642-1234. What is your go-to crockpot recipe, maybe for game day? Do you have any questions about cooking, maybe healthy cooking with a crock pot? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller now. We have Liz with us in Deerfield, Illinois. Hi, Liz.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
I sure can. What do you got for us, Liz?
This recipe is just super easy. All you have to do is you just take it to some canned goods. So I have an aunt who cans corn. And so I use a can of Wisconsin corn. I use a can of tomato paste, a jar of salsa, and 2 cans of all-white chicken meat that you use, like, for chicken salad.
Okay, put it together. What do we end up with here? What's this a recipe for?
It's a tortilla soup.
Ah, and when do you add the tortillas? You put them in right at the end?
Yep, exactly.
Wow, and is that a big hit when you make that for a party, maybe?
You know, it's a big hit when I make it for my family. It's super easy, and it's something that with a good salsa, you can kind of add whatever salsa you prefer. We like a spicy salsa, but it comes in, and it's a big hit with our family. A little sour cream and cheese.
Liz, that sounds fantastic. Jack, let's follow the soup thread. What do you recommend for a great healthy soup to make in the crock pot?
You know, it's one of the best things to do is, soup. And one of my absolute favorites is to do bean soups. And so there's a recipe we have. It's actually called a 15-bean soup with sausage and spinach. So this has something for everybody, and it uses hot or sweet Italian chicken sausage. It's got onions and garlic and thyme. The base is chicken broth and water, and then you use one of those 15-bean soup mixes, the dried mixes that you can get. We don't use the flavoring packet because we're adding our own flavors, but we love the fact you can get all those different beans in one bag. And then another great trick for delicate vegetables like the spinach, goes in 5 minutes before you're serving. So, you put the sausage and the onions and the beans and the broth and everything in the slow cooker. You go to work, come home 9 or 11 hours later, take the lid off, stir in 4 ounces of baby spinach, and just let that sit for 5 minutes. And that's enough. You don't really need to cook spinach for 11 hours. And it's got some vegetables, got some meat, got some beans, and just, on a cold, cold day, this soup is going to fill you up.
Fantastic. Liz, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We go now to Jackie in Milwaukee. Jackie, hi.
Hi, I was just curious, you mentioned the KitchenAid. A lot of my friends are getting like the 3-in-1 cookers, like Ninja and Aroma, which can also do braising and steaming. And I was just curious what he thought of those units.
Jackie, thanks for that call. And I've looked at those, Jack, and wondered too, especially the ones you can brown meat first if you want to. What do you make of those combo slow cookers?
We love the Cuisinart combo, the 4-quart 3-in-1 multi-cooker. And as you say, you can brown in it, you can saute in it, you can steam in it. They're good. Not all of them, though, so that's why, we tested about 10 different models, and that of the multi-purpose ones was our favorite. And so if you're really looking for one that can do it all, that Cuisinart 3-in-1 multi-cooker is a good model.
I worry about cleanup. If you're browning the meat, it gunks up down there, then you slow cook in it. Is that a problem?
This one's pretty easy to clean up, but you're right to be concerned. Depending on how the insert is designed and the materials, you could end up thinking, why didn't I just do the browning in a skillet? Because it's going to be awfully difficult to clean that insert. But this one's pretty easy to clean.
And that reminds me, I wanted to ask, when should we brown meat before crock-potting it?
If there's a lot of big flavors in a dish, you generally can skip the browning step. And so if you're making a dish with a lot of spices, you can skip it. If it's a dish where it's mostly about the meat and there are not a lot of other distractions, we do like to brown at least half of it. Sometimes you can get away, if it's a stew, you don't have to do all of it. You can just do one batch of it. But it's really a recipe-by-recipe case. And sometimes when we're skipping the browning, what we'll do is add some soy sauce, even if it's not an Asian recipe, to add a tablespoon or two of soy sauce can kind of make up for the fact that the meat, whether it's pork or beef, hasn't been browned. It adds, obviously, some color, but adds kind of those savory notes that you get from browning, and it's obviously a lot easier to pour a tablespoon of soy sauce into the slow cooker than to brown the meat before it goes into the slow cooker.
Now, at America's Test Kitchen, you're cooks, you're mad scientists, and one of the experiments I know you were trying on this healthy slow cooker book was to see how much salt you could do without. So how much can we cut down on the salt in our crock pot recipes?
Well, we used as little salt as possible, and there are two things you really need to think about when if you're concerned about salt. One is obviously the amount of table salt you're just adding to the pot. But most of the salt is actually coming from the canned tomatoes, the canned broth. You know, there's a lot of canned products that you end up using in a slow cooker. And we make some recommendations in the book that if you're really concerned about sodium, what brands you want to be looking for so that you can minimize the sodium content. Because a lot of times it doesn't matter how little salt you're adding. If you get a recipe that's got, you know, 6 cups of packaged chicken broth and a can or two of tomatoes, if you buy conventional brands, there's a lot of sodium in those products. And so you really need to shop carefully. And we made some specific recommendations for people who are interested in low-sodium cooking.
Jack, a lot of times I think of crockpot cooking as mainly about the convenience, but you've cooked in a number of styles and genres. How does crockpot cookery stack up in terms of deliciousness compared to all the other styles of cooking?
You know, because it's so gentle, it's one of the real benefits. And so, you know, you're really protecting the food, and it does an amazing job with grains, with beans, with things that really benefit from a steamy environment. You know, I think it's probably the best way to cook those. And, you know, we all want to be eating more whole grains. We think we should be working more beans into our diet. And it's probably the absolute best way to be cooking grains and beans. And it does a really nice job with things like hearty greens as well. It's just absolutely delicious. And because it's so goof-proof, you know, you just literally put it in and you walk away, there's a lot to be said for that.
Well, Jack, I'm walking away inspired. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Jack Bishop, editorial director for America's Test Kitchen. One of their new books, The Healthy Slow Cooker Revolution, got a great recipe for a pulled chicken sandwich on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, we'll get a preview of what's happening in the skies with the director of the planetarium at the Milwaukee Public Museum. We'll get an exit interview from the outgoing Poet Laureate of Wisconsin and talk to the new Poet Laureate about poetry's role in society and here in Wisconsin. And in our Wisconsin Life segment, we're going to learn about the modern art of quilting. That's all coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Monday after 7, it's the State Capitol Report. Joy gets a roundup of the top news from the new session of the legislature, and she'll talk to one of the Republican lawmakers at the Center of School Accountability Changes. Today was the premiere in 1959 of the TV western Rawhide, featuring a then-unknown actor named Clint Eastwood. Bit before my time, I didn't watch it, but the memory of the show lives on in its theme song. It was a hit in its own right. It's been covered by bands from the Jackson 5 to the Dead Kennedys, believe it or not. The Blues Brothers movie gave it a boost. Here's Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi using it to win over a tough crowd in a country western bar. I'm amazed they haven't made Rawhide into a big Hollywood movie reboot yet. Maybe Colin Farrell and Common in the leads. Maybe Pharrell Williams can cover the theme song. Big shot movie producers listening, call me here at the studio. We can talk, do lunch maybe. We will go out with the Rawhide theme, Frankie Lane performing. Coming up, self-driving cars are stealing the show at this year's Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. We'll take a look at how they work and when you might see them on the roads. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
My gal was by my side. All the things I'm missing, good Beatles, love and kissing, are waiting at the end of my ride. Move 'em on, hit 'em up, hit 'em up, move 'em on, hit 'em up, Rawhide. Cut 'em out, ride 'em in, cut 'em out, ride 'em in, Rawhide. Moving.